From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for August 6th, 2017, the first Sunday in August. Welcome to our weekly look at the politics and policies that shape our lives as we go from Chicago and Springfield all the way out to Washington, D.C. Time to grab the Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll try to get your week off to a good and informative start. Well, Shwani, I don't know about you, but and Sam, I'm Lollapalooza'd out, okay?
And we haven't even been yet.
Yeah.
For good or just for this year?
For good. For good. I was telling Shwani I had to go up on Thursday to an event, a political event in Lincoln Park on the afternoon, Thursday afternoon. So I end up getting on the red line, going up to Fullerton, and I got all of the, you know, Cubs traffic going up to Wrigley for the game that day. Go to the event, cover that, get on the L to come back downtown, and then it's the Lollapalooza crowd. And a very interesting phenomenon, and Sam, maybe you can explain this to me, because you're obviously decades younger than I am, okay, as you want to emphasize. But so there were like 20 young girls that got onto the L car I'm on. And I'm not sure when this became fashion that they just were wearing bras and shorts.
Oh. Well, I don't wear bras and shorts anymore.
Okay. When did you quit?
It was a rough junior year of high school for me.
No. Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, and then they wear the bathing suits with like the net, like, I don't know how to, it looks like a pillowcase with holes in it, and they wear that over the bathing suit, right?
I haven't seen that.
No, I haven't either. Hmm. Don't go to the same beach as you do. But
this is just walking down Michigan Avenue, walking toward Lollapalooza every year. You see the most wild outfits you could ever imagine.
Yeah,
I can't imagine mom and dad put their little baby girl on the train looking like that.
Well, but see, that's what I'm kind of figuring here is that this is after mom and dad have gone to work. And that's when they get dressed and this kind of thing. I had to consult my daughters over this fashion style, and they informed me that it came from Miley Cyrus. So, you know, there's a cultural icon to shoot for as a role model. Dead silence. I
trying to come back with something we could say on the radio.
Swanee's googling Miley Cyrus.
I know who she is.
I don't know.
I got to tell you though, I just for fun did get out some of my old 45 RPM records because they were all making fun of me last week because I didn't know the names of any of the bands at Lollapalooza, and we were talking about groups like Tommy James and the Shondells last week. And Sly and the Family Stone. And, boy, talk about a trip down memory lane, to use a well-worn cliche. I found all those records in a box, so I still have them.
Well, you better and save them and put them away and make sure that they won't get warped or anything like
that.
Oh,
right. Oh, yeah. They're kept properly in, you know, a climate-controlled closet.
How do you play?
Which means my air conditioning.
How do you play a 45 these days?
Well, I still have a turntable and the adapter that you use for the big hole in the middle of the record.
Really?
Easy. Oh, sure. Yeah.
And do you have it, like, then wired into a modern stereo
system? Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, sure. No problem. I can. I've made sure over the years that, you know, with all of the changes in technology from when CDs first came out, you and I are old enough to remember that.
Thank you.
through everything else now, you know, downloading music and all of that, I've always made sure that you know, when it comes down to it, you want to get back to basics and play vinyl. I can play vinyl.
But do you have one of those adapters that you can also record it digitally off the off the turntable?
I can kind of jury-rig a system whereby I can, yes, an output.
So it means you just leave your phone next to a speaker and hit record?
No, you just gave it away. But no, if I wanted to, I've got a system whereby I could run a wire from my amplifier, the output, into my computer. Basic software that I could do that with. Ah. So I could do it if I wanted to.
But there's something about vinyl.
Nothing like it. And nothing like it.
I mean, I guess it's making a comeback.
In a manner of speaking, it is. In fact, Sam, I think you'll back me up on this. Some of the groups that are putting out new music these days are offering the option of vinyl.
Yes, very true.
See? And then I've also seen, by the same token, some things that have been reissued on vinyl, older recordings. You'll get a note inside saying, we would like you, we will invite you to a free download of this. They'll give you a web link, and you can download what you've wanted on vinyl, so you could take it with you, you know, in the car or, you know, on whatever device you may have.
But when you see some of this music that's digitally remastered, is that take away what the original kind of vinyl feel was?
Yes, it can, especially if it's done kind of on the fly. I can remember when, you know, some of the older material was first coming out on CD, and they would make this big deal about it being digitally remastered. Well, it didn't sound all that good, you know, so it was a learning curve for engineering and people that were doing this to make it sound a little bit better, you know, taking out some noise and giving it a vinyl thing. I've got albums that sound better than the CD equivalents.
Oh, I would think so.
You know, I'm in some cases, I'm glad I kept the original vinyl, because I would get the CD when it first came out, and I'm listening as this isn't quite the same.
Is it more like notes aren't as robust?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, they aren't things, you know, in other words, the full fidelity of the record isn't here. You know, a bass player, for example, not as bassy, not as full as you'd want it. And therefore not as present and as exciting as you would want the music to be.
And you want exciting music, not like what we get from Johnny Six Note playing the sax out
now,
in front of the tower.
He's making an artistic statement. That is the music of the river.
I thought we were supposed to be cleaning up our rivers.
I like how this went from Lollapalooza to Swanee's. You know, Swanee's trying to guide it away from the teenagers making out in the mud.
Well, I gotta imagine after that downpour Thursday.
Oh, they were pigs in mud, literally.
You were there?
No, but this happens every year. You see the pictures of it. I went to Lollapalooza one time, and it's because I wanted to see the Red Hot Chili Peppers live.
Okay.
Well, there would be a good band to hear.
So I did that. I forget who else I saw. I think it was Jane's Addiction, and the owner of the front man of Jane's Addiction is the one who founded Lollapalooza. They played right before Red Hot Chili Peppers. It was on a Saturday, and it's just not my scene. And it did rain that day, but when it rains at Lollapalooza, the people, they eat it up. They're rolling around in the mud.
Was that the year that everybody ran over to Michigan Avenue in the middle of the afternoon? Was that the concert you got caught in with the rain?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that happened, although that could be a trend. That could happen all the time. I'm not sure. I only have one day to
vouch. A Lollapalooza tradition.
Well,
a rainout.
Yeah, and as well as a sod repair that takes a year over at Grant Park.
Yeah, when they get done with the repairs from last year, then it's time for Lollapalooza all over again.
Obviously, it ain't my thing. Although, today being the last day, I mean, Arcade Fire, who I've heard of, and I think they're pretty good, but I was kind of laughing because last week during Stephen Colbert's show, they had Arcade Fire on before their thing here at Lollapalooza, and they printed out on the Twitter feed the list of band demands, and apparently this band is being sponsored by some global marketing firm, and so they were requiring that some energy drink be sitting on Stephen Colbert's desk for the entire show, You know, nobody could talk to any band member. Nobody could talk to the lead singer, even if he talked to you first. I mean, just this whole list of demands. So I was very curious when Stephen Colbert actually had them on, because they were kind of mocking this. And Colbert actually, like, presented the name of the marketing company and pulled out a can of this energy drink and, I mean, basically did a commercial for him. And it's like, is that what it takes to get musical entertainment on a TV show these days? Is everything so corporatized
and commercialized?
I mean, I thought that was part of the, you know, allure of the indie music and that kind of thing, is just to get away from the corporatization of things.
Yeah. Good point.
I don't like those demands. I miss the days when Van Halen would ban brown M&Ms.
Right, yes. You only had
backstage
to have the blue M&Ms. And I think they said for their food demand, one package of vegan hot dogs.
Mm.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, what's the point? Right? What can I say? I don't get it. I don't get it. But, you know, it's not just been all the kids and stuff with Lala. There's been, I mean, a lot of adult tourists in town. A lot of people in town from Ohio and Michigan, things like that. I don't know if this is kind of like we're coming up to the last flings of vacation, or if these happen to be just parents of kids who are going to Lala, and so they're seeing the rest of the city, that kind of thing. But I told Dave off the air that sitting out at the Tree of Knowledge here with Rick Hogan last week, and we had three people back to back to back asking for directions for places. It's like the Tree of Knowledge concierge table over here. And, I mean, and very helpful and that kind of thing. And, I mean, nobody asking that goofy thing like, where's the water? But the strangest one, though, I did think is, you know, here we are on Michigan Avenue, right across from the river, and someone asking desperately how to get to Wacker Drive. Which
right over the bridge.
Right over that bridge.
Just go that way.
And then the second person, how do you get to Navy Pier? So I point them to the staircase that has the arch over it that says this way to Navy Pier. And it's a good thing that everybody's got these smartphones that have turned out to be so helpful in life, isn't it?
Oh, I just thought of one I got some years back. Now, Rick and Sam, you guys know where I live, right?
We know where you live. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Me.
It was the reason I say that, it was because it was in my neighborhood, and I'm walking down the street, standing at an intersection, waiting for a light to change. A car pulls up, and the woman in the passenger side rolls down the window and said, "Where's Midway Airport?"
Huh?
Yeah.
What?
Where's Midway? Thinking that it was
somewhere right. Yeah, it's just
in
around
the
block.
Said,
yeah, yeah.
Well, you've got a little ways to go, actually. So I did my best to guide them to, to get on to 55 and then get off at Cicero,
right,
and then go down from there. But I said, "You're not close. You're not close."
Well, I've had a couple of times out here in front of Tribune Tower, people asking me how long of a walk it is to Wrigley Field.
A walk to Wrigley Field?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
I haven't had that.
And I've suggested that the easier walk is over to the Grandin State Red Line.
Yeah.
And,
yes. And then get off at Addison.
Yeah. How long a walk it would be. I don't know. But I can't. I don't want to say this, but I am pretty touristed out. I just, the people, two people to a revolving door kind of thing. It's just, you know, that's all kind of, I'm tired of it.
That's about a 90-minute walk from Tribune Tower to Wrigley. I think it's about 90 minutes.
Is it?
That would be my guess, yes.
That would be quite a walk.
Do you want to start now, Sam?
Yeah.
We could do a remote.
I'll be done by the time Dean's show starts. If I leave right now, I'll get there at 8:51.
Well, see, we can fill in for you.
All right, see ya.
All right. Enjoy the game.
Check in periodically, will you?
We don't want you to
get
lost.
You can do your sports on the road.
That's it. It's a road game. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Sam's got all of the sports, including the latest walking tour to Wrigley. Producer Jasmine's here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is here checking out all of the traffic going on Michigan Avenue on this partly cloudy Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. You can find all of our You can find our shows on WGNRadio.com. And if you have to tune away, you can get them there. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead, after Dave gives us the 7:30 news update, we'll speak with Illinois Senate Republican leader Bill Brady of Bloomington. We'll talk about the school funding controversy that's engulfed Springfield and the entire state as the days get closer before schools are supposed to open. Dave's back with a news update at 8, and then we'll talk to Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. The sweetened beverage tax is on everybody's mind, and we'll talk about that with her, about the tax levy and a related lawsuit. We'll have more news and sports at 8:30, and then we'll be joined by my good friend Tony Arnold. Tony's the state political reporter for WBEZ-FM in Chicago. We'll talk about the schools issue, Governor Rauner, and the race for governor. That's all coming up, but first it's time for a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Okay, that's enough of Miley Cyrus. Thank you so much, Bob, for finding that. Fade it all the way. Get out of my head, please. Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin, and it's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And I think we can start with a moment of peace as President Donald Trump headed off Friday for a 17-day vacation. Now, of course, he doesn't say it's a vacation. Tweeted out yesterday, working in Bedminster, New Jersey, as long-planned construction is being done at the White House. This is not a vacation. Meeting and calls! Exclamation point. So, but still, you have to admit, it has been relatively quiet for a little bit, and we'll see how quiet that vacation stays now that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is moving forward with a grand jury investigation into the president's campaign, and whether any top aide to the president is really ever safe in this White House. We'll see. But I want to take you back to the last presidential campaign and remind you what then-candidate Donald Trump said about President Obama and Obama playing golf and taking vacations and how that was a big no-no, according to Trump. Well, CNN did the counting. At this time of his presidency, Barack Obama took 21 days off. Trump has now taken 41 days off, and many of them to play golf, even though the White House won't talk about it. Here's CNN's compilation of Trump's thoughts on Obama's days off, golf, and vacations.
Obama, it was reported today, played 250 rounds of golf.
Everything's executive order, because he doesn't have enough time because he's playing so much golf.
Obama ought to get off the golf course and get down there.
I'm going to be working for you. I'm not going to have time to go play golf.
He played more golf last year than Tiger Woods.
This guy plays more golf than people on the PGA Tour.
I love golf. I think it's one of the greats, but I don't have time.
But if I were in the White House, I don't think I'd ever see Turnberry again. I don't think I'd ever see Doral again.
But I'm not going to be playing much golf, believe me. If I win this, I'm not going to be playing much golf.
I wouldn't leave the White House very much because, you know, like little things like these little trips where they get on, they cost you a fortune.
I love working. I'm not a vacation guy.
I don't take vacations. I'm not like Obama where he takes Air Force One to Hawaii.
I don't take vacations.
I promise you, I will not be taking very long vacations if I take them at all. There's no time for vacation.
Other people, they go away for weeks and weeks. I don't like taking vacations.
Obama likes relaxing and going on vacations. Me, I like working. I like working. I really do.
If I get elected president, I'm going to be in the White House a lot. I'm not leaving. We have deals to make. Who the hell wants to leave, right?
So that is then-candidate Donald Trump talking about vacations as he is in the now second full day of his vacation. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with the new Illinois Senate Republican leader, Bill Brady, from Bloomington. We'll be talking about the issues involving the school funding stalemate that exists with the first state checks supposed to go out to schools from the comptroller's office on Thursday, but doesn't look like that's going to happen. We'll talk about that with Bill Brady.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. Just to catch up a little bit more on our national spin of what's going on. Republicans are getting mighty concerned about the president, and it's probably vacation's probably a good time. And with General Kelly now at chief of staff, it seems to be somewhat of a moderating force. But as the Senate took off, for its August recess, and remember, the president had told them to stay in and finish repealing Obamacare. Well, Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins, she was a no vote on those Senate health care plans. She needs some peace as well. She said the president just shouldn't govern by Twitter.
I personally don't think that governing or setting policy by tweet is a wise approach. It creates confusion. It does not give details. These are serious issues that we're dealing with. I do understand why it's attractive to the president to be able to get his message out. But when it comes to an issue that has widespread implications, whether it's health care or the transgender issue for our military, I just don't think a tweet is the right way to go. I think he should have a serious policy discussion with his cabinet, with those who are responsible for implementing policy, because then there's much more clarity in how to proceed.
Now, let's also remember that last week, the president bragged about phone calls he got from the head of the Boy Scouts, lauding his highly political speech at the Boy Scout Jamboree. Trump also talked about his phone call with the president of Mexico, except there weren't any phone calls. But when asked at a White House briefing by Cecilia Vega of ABC News if the president was lying about it, spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders said no.
Why did the president say that he received a phone call from the leader of the Boy Scouts and the president of Mexico when he did not? Did he lie?
No, on Mexico, he was referencing the conversation that they had had at the G20 summit where they specifically talked about the issues that he referenced. In terms of the Boy Scouts, multiple members of the Boy Scout leadership following his speech there that day congratulated him, praised him, and offered quite powerful compliments following his speech, and those were what those references were about.
But the president specifically said that he received a phone call from the president of Mexico.
They were actually direct. They were direct conversations, not actual phone calls.
So he lied. He didn't receive.
I wouldn't say it was a lie. That's pretty bold accusation. It's the conversations took place. They just simply didn't take place over a phone call that he had them in person, John.
Okay, so I guess alternative facts maybe have not gone away. Well, we're going to switch gears here and talk about more local issues. And joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio, I'm very happy to have Bill Brady. He is the Illinois Senate Republican leader designate. I thought you guys had voted already, but from Bloomington. And Senator Brady, thank you so much for joining me here in the studio this morning.
Good to be with you.
Good to be anywhere on a Sunday morning, right? Well, obviously, we are in this new impasse, son of budget impasse.
son of budget, okay.
The kind of the sequel to the budget impasse now with the issue of school funding for the state. And just to kind of explain things, that when the budget was enacted, the state school aid funding for local schools, that component of the budget, was contingent upon other legislation. And I believe the language was identical in both the Senate version, Democratic version that passed, as well as the Republican version, that it had to be based on this new
evidence-based formula. Right.
So some people have said this was a poison pill, but frankly, it was in both pieces of legislation to enact the budget, but it's just which version of that do we go with. So the Senate Democrats finally released the hold on the bill that passed May 31st, sent it to the governor on July 31st. Governor used his amendatory veto on it. Most notably, and gaining most attention, was excising parts dealing with the Chicago Public Schools. Also made truly a number of other changes in this legislation. And now he is saying, support my mandatory veto or bring me a new bill. And we hear there's talks. We hear there aren't talks. We hear there's talks that have broken off. You're the Senate Republican leader. Is anybody talking, or are they just talking out loud?
Well, there are negotiations. Leader Durkin and I, as well as Speaker Madigan and President Culleton, have appointed designees to work out some remaining issues, whether they be in the mandatory veto. But we are trying to work diligently to solve this, what I'll call manufactured crisis. Unfortunately, the Senate Democrats held under parliamentary maneuver the evidence-based funding bill, Senate Bill 1, for an extended period of time. They did send it to the governor. The governor acted expeditiously on trying to resolve this, what I'll call manufactured crisis. This all came about based on evidence that the Senate Republican caucus provided years ago about how inequitable education funding is in the state. And that was the precursor to the evidence-based model, which we all think is a better way to provide resources based on the ability of local resources. So the model was important. The governor expeditiously acted on it. It is holding up payments to go to schools, which is a grave risk for us. I think the best thing to do would be for the Democrats to accept the governor's mandatory veto. We'll continue to work on everything that needs to be worked on to improve school funding beyond that, but that would allow payments to flow immediately to school districts, I think at a level higher than ever in history, and at a fairer level based on local resources.
Now, in looking at this legislation, and again, there's been a lot of attention placed on the issue of Chicago Public Schools and the fact that what the governor's action would do would eliminate a block grant that the schools have received historically since 1995 to cover what's known as categorical funding, over $200 million there. And instead of having to file every time with for each student, it was kind of aimed to do it that way. And frankly, in Senate Bill 1 as passed, the block grant would go away in another year anyway.
Well, yeah, the it depends on the timing of things, but what was offered here was we pay for the pensions in every school district outside of Chicago directly, and the state has that responsibility. Years ago, Chicago chose to retain its responsibility for its own pensions. They were over 100% funded, I think.
Yeah, it was 110% funded in 95.
And so over the last 10 years, they have neglected that pension, and it's been in a difficult position. Essentially, what we said is we want parity across the board. And we want Chicago school children to have the same parity as Bloomington children or Cairo children or whatever. That's what's important is the children. So what we did is we agreed that we would provide parity when it came to pension funding, but everything else had to be equal and based on, low income, local property tax value and ability and all those things. That's the evidence.
Like 27 or so base factors.
Exactly. There's a lot of what some people will call levers, factors, other things that were created by the commission that the governor appointed, a bipartisan commission that came up with several things. And so there are much that's in agreement. And I think the foundation of the agreement was based on parity. Let's have, if we're going to agree that those factors should weigh into where state resources go at a percentage, then let's also agree that that then becomes parity. So the argument was, and we know Chicago's got challenges that other school districts do not have, and we certainly don't want to do anything to harm Chicago school students, but we want parity. And so the idea was that we'll do this. The other factor in all of this is, as you know, is there is what they call a hold harmless.
Right.
And one of the key factors for us is that there would be a movement from a per school district hold harmless. If you're going to have parity, it should be based on the number of students that those levers were based on.
And I want to hold you right there, because I think there are a number of questions when we discuss that issue of hold harmless and how the Senate Bill 1 as passed would do it versus how the governor's mandatory veto would change that. Right. And I think there's a lot of concern about that throughout the state. We're speaking with Bill Brady. He's the incoming Senate Republican leader, state senator from Bloomington. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on a cloudy North Michigan Avenue, and joining me here in studio this morning is Illinois Senate Republican Leader Bill Brady from Bloomington. We're talking about son of budget impasse, the school funding issue. And one of the things before the break, so everybody agrees on the issue of hold harmless, that no school district should get less money next year than it got this year. But
eventually it should phase into parity.
But there are various components in various versions of what hold harmless means. The Democrats would argue we're talking about that block grant. Well, that ought to be part of the hold harmless. That's not what the Republican version says. But one critical thing in Senate Bill 1, as the Democrats passed it, was that the hold harmless was basically set a floor. That was a hold harmless that went in perpetuity.
Right. Regardless of class size.
Or
school district enrollment.
Right. And so the bill, as changed by the governor, would end that phase. That would be gone in 2 years, and instead it would be based on the average three-year enrollment.
Right.
But it would be, instead of per district hold harmless, it would be by student population. And there have been a lot of concerns, I think, and I'm curious your thought here, because for downstate districts, I mean, a number of them, and frankly, there are hundreds of districts that in the last couple of years that have lost enrollment. Right. And of course, everybody points to CPS, and of course, yes, they've lost enrollment. But, I mean, literally hundreds of districts that have lost enrollment.
I think Naperville's lost enrollment. So the point here is, if you're going to have an evidence-based model that's based on parity, and I don't want to get too far in the weeds, because the key is that we get Senate Bill 1 as amended, enacted, so money can flow. But the logic behind this is, and I don't know any school superintendent that doesn't look at out-year enrollment. We're looking at populations. Every business is looking at what's the growth of our students, and so we know those numbers. So you plan. It's not an immediate based on last year. It's a three-year phase, and as you say, everyone should be looking at the future, and you should plan, just like businesses plan for the market. School districts should plan for market size, and that's a fair way, I believe, in keeping parity.
But doesn't that also create the problem that some of these districts in rural areas that have been seeing enrollment declines, that they would also be, quote, losers?
And they may be, and then in some cases, school districts might choose on their own to merge and create economies of scale and do things that
Is that part of for years, obviously, there's
part of
been
this,
efforts.
But my effort, I think we do have too many governments in Illinois, okay? And there are certain places in my area. I remember when Gridley School District, which was adamantly opposed to any consolidation or merger, chose on their own, as they should, to merge with El Paso School District so the two combined could maximize the resources for the students. That's a natural evolution based on demographic movements. We know that.
But we also know there's a great reluctance. And part of it is, you know, in some of these rural areas that the school is the last identity for these towns. Well,
absolutely. Everyone
they've lost
to protect
their post
their
office.
Not what this is about, though. What this is about is about enacting a bill that will provide resources to the school immediately. More, I think, at historic highs and in a historic way that creates parity. And that's what this is about. It was held hostage for nearly 30 days, longer than it should have been. Some would say 60.
I was going to say.
Some would say 60. But it's time to act. And it's the governor expeditiously acted on his amendatory veto. He gave his input. I would say that Senate Republicans, our caucus, gave its input into the negotiation process. We continue to be willing to talk. We're reasonable. We're always willing to discuss things. Our negotiators are at the table constantly trying to do anything we can to bring resolution to this. We're hopeful that the Democrats enact what's in front of them, but we're not going to walk away and just hope that they do. We're still willing to talk. There's ways that we can do better things.
And it's hard not to get into the weeds when it comes to this. I mean, I've probably more in the last 6 months learned about factors in this bill.
Right.
Then, I mean, I was joking. I go back to when Gene Hoffman was in the Illinois right. House, and he was the last guy I knew that knew how the school aid formula worked, right. Which also says something about, you know, how long things have been under this kind of mess that yeah. we call a school aid formula. But I want to also ask you about now the whole idea of the whole harmless going from district to pupil, that was part of the Republican version of this bill.
Well, I think it's the definition of parity.
I'm just saying, but yeah. that's already been out there. One of the other things that the governor changed, and this does go a little bit in the weeds, though, is the issue about, as part of the measure of what a school district would receive from the state, would be based on the assessed valuation of the property that exists within the school district.
That's not – the Hold Harmless protects every district at current levels. So that's only in the new money that goes
correct.
Into the new
okay.
funding.
So in the new money – and we're talking out years.
Right.
But now school districts would have to factor in money that they can't or assessed valuation that they can't tap for property tax purposes in the suburbs, yeah. Communities that are under the property tax caps. In Chicago, a number of suburbs, places downstate, areas that are TIFT, that are tax increment financing districts, where that's money that they can't access, but yet that would be figured into the valuation that would affect how much state money they would get in the out years.
And this is the new funding. Everyone would
right.
be held harmless.
But I guess that would seem to be a double whammy or a penalization factor, because you're under a property tax cap, you can't access more wealth, yeah. but then you're being penalized because of that, because you will not get more state money.
Well, I think it'd be interesting to see how the numbers come out on this. I mean, we haven't seen the numbers as they're affected, and the data is going to be difficult, I think, to attain.
I don't see, and we should say the governor has said on Monday or Tuesday with his rewrite of the bill that yeah. that will be scored, as it were,
and
by
I'd
the
be surprised
State Board of
if
Education.
It was Monday. It'd probably more into Tuesday.
But they won't score out years. They'll just score it under the first year.
Sure, because they don't
correct.
Know. The data is difficult to attain. And it'd be interesting to see what the State Board does. But the concept does get back to parity. But I think the numbers, and we really do need to look at the numbers here to see how it affects. But if every community is equally, as a percentage, used tax increment financing districts to create growth, if it's equal, then it should be relatively equal across the board. I think it is important to see the numbers.
Yeah, well, I mean, because, I mean, I understand concepts, but then, I mean, but a number of superintendents, quite frankly, on social media have given some of the yeah. governor's remarks last week, were expressing concern. And I have to tell you, a number of them were downstate school superintendents.
Well, we've used tax increment financing just like Chicago has. I mean, no city probably has leveraged tax increment financing districts more than the city of Chicago.
True, and there's a great argument to be made about.
But I know, you know, there are tax increment financing districts in rural Illinois. It's a development
yes.
tool that helps create wealth and growth and prosperity.
Yeah, I mean, it takes the growth in property taxes instead of going to schools or the local taxing body. It's basically used to regenerate to try
exactly.
to help regenerate.
And
the
in some
area.
Areas, we wouldn't have that growth without without those. So they've, in some cases, those that growth has saved school districts because that growth creates families, and families create children and students.
Now, one other thing is, now the whole idea of, obviously we know about the governor taking out the money that was to go to the pensions in Chicago, taking it out of the school code, and
which I think was paramount in terms of parity. Over here in the pension area, we fund downstate teachers' retirement system, and that's where, if we're going to bring parity there, and I think we should, that's where Chicago teachers should go.
And his mandatory veto would move that from the school code back into the pension section.
Correct.
Now, of course,
there it's various, a dollar for dollar exchange. Yeah, it's not a cost to Chicago.
But it's moving it from one set of the statutes to another set of the statutes. And of course there's questions there about the constitutionality of being able to do that. Okay. But that having been said, the legislation also kind of anticipated that at some point down the road, and we've heard Speaker Madigan even support kind of this concept, that the pensions, more of the pension costs be picked up by the locals.
Well we've incorporated into this budget, one of the negotiations was a Tier 3 pension program, which shifts local cost of pensions for universities or schools to the local units of government.
But the language in the mandatory veto would affect that, the calculation of school resources used to pay those pensions. I mean, that would take that out as a factor in consideration of how much state
right
revenue they
get. But it shifts the burden to the local units who are responsible, frankly, for the pensions in terms of they're the ones that dictate the pensions because they dictate the salaries.
Right.
And so it's a good move there, and it creates consistency by having all teachers' pensions come from one area of the state budget versus one coming within school funding and one not.
No, understood. But with local districts picking up in anticipation of picking up an ever and ever and ever greater share of the pension
and
liability.
I've supported that when it comes to normal cost. I want to differentiate here because it would be unfair, in my opinion, to expect local school districts to pick up the legacy or the unfunded costs from previous years. But normal cost, I think it brings more responsibility to budgeting.
Not arguing the concept. The only thing is if more of the revenues derived by a local school district and their local funds are going to be used for pension, shouldn't that factor be considered in how much state revenue they get? Because it appears that the governor's change would affect that.
But they will, as we've shifted these normal costs for existing employees to the pension funding, just like we do for everyone. So it creates parity.
Okay. Well, here we are, our trip through the weeds of school funding.
We did get quite deep. That's okay, though.
Are we going to get something done? We're not going to get anything done before the 10th.
Yeah, I don't. I hope we could get something done Wednesday or Thursday. I've asked the negotiators who are representing Senate Republicans to do everything they can to get something done so that we could come back Wednesday or Thursday. President Colton has told me if we don't, he plans to call us back on Sunday.
The 13th.
13th, and we will go from there. Sooner the better. There's a solution, that bipartisan solution that is reasonable and can be met. Unfortunately, things take time, but the sooner the better. I know my caucus is anxious to get something in place so we can move on to other issues.
And we'll all be down there for the state fair. So
I don't know. Are Democrats coming to the state fair, or are they not?
They're coming to the state fair. They're just not in an organized way, as I understand it. But then you could make your own joke.
Another half-hour discussion.
Illinois Senate Republican Leader Bill Brady of Bloomington, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, and thanks to your listeners.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, and welcome back to the Sunday Spin. One of President Trump's biggest critics in the Senate, Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona, is out with a new book, and he's highly critical of the president. He borrowed the title of Barry Goldwater's famous book, Conscience of a Conservative. And Jeff Flake told CBS that conservatives really need to have some civility.
I think it has to start with demeanor. We have to model behavior that we'd be proud that our kids are watching. Because, like I said, we're not going to tackle the big issues. In the book, I talk about how when our chief military officials, General Mattis, also Bob Gates when he was still in position, were asked what the biggest problems were. They didn't talk about North Korea or Iran or the Middle East. They said the lack of civility and the lack of people getting along here in Congress, and that turning inward, we are the biggest problem here. And until we fix that, until we recognize that we've got to get together, whether it's on health care or taxes, if we want to move ahead on those issues and have something that the president can sign, I would submit we'd better start looking across the aisle.
That's Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake. Well, we're going to switch gears here and talk about politics and governance more locally. And joining me now on the phone is Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. Madam President, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Rick.
I know it's been a very interesting week with the now imposition by the county of the sweetened beverage tax. A lot of people talking about this all over the place. A lot of people not happy with it. A lot of confusion, it seems, with the way retailers are enforcing it on even on items that it shouldn't be taxed. I know that people talk about, well, this is an effort for encouraging health, but we also know it's a significant revenue factor that you had built in about $68 million in the county budget on this. I'm not sure if it's possible. Are you getting any positive feedback on this?
Well, thank you very much, Rick. You know, I do get positive feedback from people, first of all, from our advocates, the American Heart Association, the American Diabetes Association, the American Dental Association, all the folks who worked hard with us last fall as we proposed this tax. And they supported, as I supported, first and foremost because we need revenue, and secondly because this is a way to raise revenue, which also has positive health benefits. You know, I think there's no argument in the research that the high sugar content of these beverages, the real and artificial sugars are really bad for you. And the World Health Organization, clearly an important third-party affirmer here, says that national governments, state and local governments ought to impose these taxes to reduce consumption. And the state of Mexico has done that. And, of course, we're more familiar with Philadelphia and Berkeley and more recently Seattle, which have imposed similar taxes.
A lot of people have been raising to me the question, and we know it's a sweetened beverage tax, but it also includes artificial sweeteners. And the question being that, yes, I mean, everybody recognizes that having too much of real sugar or corn syrup or those kinds of sweeteners is definitely a health issue. But why the Diet Cokes? Why the Diet Pepsis? Why the artificially sweetened drinks?
Well, artificially sweetened drinks aren't good for you either. Clearly, the sugar sweetened and high fructose corn syrup sweetened beverages are worse. But none of it is good for you. And you know, in some of our poorer communities in the city and in the county, young people, that is, our kids, get 25% of their calories from sweetened beverages. And I think it's really important that we understand that the beverage companies market these products disproportionately in poor black and brown communities. And, of course, those are the communities that face the most challenges in terms of health consequences. So, you know, I think it's really important that people understand, first and foremost, that if you want to have good government, you got to pay for it. And secondly, that it makes sense for us to raise revenues in ways that have other benefits. You know, we tax cigarettes in this country. And in the 1960s, as the research showed overwhelmingly that cigarette smoking was bad for you, 42% of adults in this country smoked. And we imposed high taxes at all levels, federal, state, and local. We had a public education campaign, and we also restricted where people could smoke. And now 15% of adults smoke. And I think all of us would agree over the last 50 years that that's a good outcome. Even people who smoke, I'm not sure would argue that it's a good thing to be doing. So I think the research has shown that these things are not good for us. We have to raise revenues in some way. And the way in which we chose to do it was to raise taxes on sweetened beverages, which we knew had positive health benefits.
You've mentioned cigarettes, and I almost had to wonder, would you consider this as some form of a sin tax, as they're known?
I think I'd just say it's a tax that has positive health benefits. And let me just say, I would be happy if we didn't raise any money from cigarettes, because I know how bad cigarettes are for you. My grandfather died of emphysema. He was a pack-a-day smoker, and I just remember as a kid being heartbroken as I watched him struggle for breath and of course, ultimately succumb to it. So, I think we should do things in government that we need to do to raise revenue. And if we can also have positive health benefits from raising that revenue, all to the good.
One person that I talked to was just curious about, now it's a penny an ounce, but whether at some point that could even be scaled back somewhat. I mean, when you look at buying a 2-liter bottle of pop, you're talking about a tax roughly of about 70 cents, and that's almost half of the price of the bottle of soda. Is that somewhere in the out years that might be considered?
I think if you look at the pattern with cigarettes, we haven't reduced taxes, we've raised them. I wouldn't expect that. The advocates are quite clear that the tax needs to be at least a penny an ounce in order to have an impact, that is, to reduce consumption, which is what you want to do.
I know when the tax levy was being held up in the courts, there was the talk of all of the layoffs, and indeed some county employees did receive layoff notices. I'm wondering, now that the tax is imposed, how does that affect those layoffs that had been planned or had been executed?
Well, first of all, I guess I should have begun here. A lot of people don't understand exactly what the county does. So 46% of our budget is health care. So almost half of our budget goes into the health and hospital system. We have Stroger Hospital on the near west side, we have Provident Hospital on the mid-south side, we have a hospital in the jail, CIRMAC, we have 16 ambulatory, that's walk-in clinics and specialty clinics around the county, and we run a Medicaid expansion program called County Care, which your listeners may be familiar with.
Right.
That's the program that was enabled by the Affordable Care Act to provide insurance to low-wage workers. Basically, anybody who makes minimum wage or less is eligible to be in the Medicaid expansion program. And we have 500,000 people, 480,000 people in Cook County that got health care coverage as a result of the Affordable Care Act. So 46% of our budget is health care. 41% is public safety. So that's running our criminal courts and running the jails, basically. So 87% of our budget is in those two buckets. Last fall, we realized that in order to provide the same quality, high quality of service that people expect from the county, we had two choices, one either to lay off 1,100 people or the other was to raise revenue, and we chose to raise revenue. And since 87% of our budget is public health and public safety, when you're laying off people, you're laying off doctors and nurses in our healthcare system, you're laying off state's attorneys and public defenders and correctional officers in our public safety arena, because that's where we spend the money. And as we anticipated not having the revenue as a result of the suit by the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, we sent layoff notices, and those layoff notices went to the same categories of folks that I just said, doctors, nurses, state's attorneys, public defenders, and correctional officers. So that was... the worst part of my job is having to lay off people.
But will some of those layoffs be rescinded now that the tax is in effect?
Well, here's the difficulty. We've lost revenue for more than a month, and in addition, revenue at the time when people consume the most sweetened beverages, that's over the summer. People have picnics and barbecues and family reunions and whatever. And in addition, the budget that was passed by the state imposed for the first time an administrative fee for collecting our sales tax revenues. This is the first time that the state has done this. And let me just point out, the county collects property taxes for every taxing body in the county. Every city, every town, every village, every school district, every mosquito abatement district, lighting district, water reclamation district. We collect taxes for them. We don't charge them. That's our job. But the state, in order to balance its budget, decided that it was going to take this administrative fee in collecting sales tax revenue. So that's had an impact on us, too. So it's not just the loss of revenue in the sweetened beverage tax. It's these changes that the state imposed on us in the budget that got passed. So we find ourselves in a difficult position. Instead of making 10% cuts, we're going to have to make 5% cuts. And I can't predict exactly how this is going to play out. That is, whether there'll be reduced layoffs or no layoffs. But we've asked our separately elected officials, our bureau chiefs, our department heads, to make layoffs of frontline staff the last resort.
We're speaking with Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We're speaking to Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, and we're talking about the imposition of the sweetened beverage tax, a lot of questions that are out there. And Madam President, one of the biggest questions, I'm going to let one of our regular callers, Ron, ask you this. Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, Ms. Preckwinkle, my question to you is that you said that these beverages are targeted toward low-income communities. I need a point of some clarification, because I heard that it excludes people who use food stamps, and those are usually the low-income people. So how are you discouraging them from buying these beverages?
Thank you, Ron.
Well, the point I made is that the beverage companies target low-income, particularly African-American and Latino communities. However, food stamps are – this is a federal program, and the federal government does not allow states or local units of government like the county to tax food stamps in any way. So it's – food stamps are not subject to sales taxes, and they're not subject to taxes like our sweetened beverage tax.
I also want to ask you about the issue of the lawsuit that against the Illinois Retail Merchants Association and trying to recoup the $17 million that the county says that it lost because of the court rulings that had blocked the imposition of this tax. A lot of people expressing some concern about this, some people even suggesting this is like a slap lawsuit. And the question of, you know, doesn't somebody have the right to go to court and contest or question the legality of ordinances and laws that are passed by government?
Sure they do. In this instance, however, it had a very dramatic consequence in terms of county revenues. And let me just say, we enacted this law, this tax, last November. We issued the rules and regs in March. We had more than 30 face-to-face meetings, conference calls with stakeholders before we were to implement it on July 1st. And actually, we tweaked the rules and regulations three or four times in response to concerns raised by the retail merchants and others. You know, the retail merchants could have started this suit in November, in which case it would have been resolved by July 1st, and we would have been in a much better position to determine where we were before the end of the fiscal year. And they timed their suit to inflict maximum damage on the county.
But you don't think that there's any deleterious effect on just the right to be able to question government in this way?
No, I don't think so. I think they exercise their right to challenge our action, and we're counter-suing.
Want to switch a little bit and ask you about, with all of the things going on as far as the Senate Republicans in Washington and the issue of health care, you touched on county care and basically how much of health care is what the county does. And we keep wondering about, you know, what is going to be the outcome that comes out of Washington. Certainly, if anything, warnings about things like the Medicaid expansion that's allowed more people to receive health care, about federal funding for that really being on the chopping block. But beyond that, we don't really know what else might come from a repeal and replacement plan. I'm wondering, you know, we hear that the governor says he's concerned about it, but we have also seen other Republican governors, John Kasich in Ohio and others, you know, basically kind of going to the forefront and urging Republicans in Congress to talk with the Democrats to do something. What do you hear about what may come, or is it just a matter that Republicans are kind of, after 7 years of repeal and replace, just can't figure out what they're doing?
Well, I think it's important for our listeners to know what the Affordable Care Act has done for folks in Cook County. I think I said earlier, almost 500,000 people have gotten health care coverage as a result of the Affordable Care Act. 500,000 people, most of those through Medicaid expansion. We have a Medicaid expansion managed care program called County Care, but Blue Cross Blue Shield and other private providers have also had this Medicaid expansion program. 500,000 people, and the Republican proposal, the last one that failed, would have denied health care access to federally supported health care to 16 million people. The previous proposals range from 24 to 30 million people that would lose their health care or not be eligible for health care in the future. I mean, these are just would have devastating effects on Americans. And we're making progress toward access to care for everyone. And rescinding the Affordable Care Act, repealing it, would just have devastating consequences, not just for the people who were getting insurance for the first time in their lives, many of them, but also for our health care providers. You know, in 2010, when I came in office, the taxpayers of Cook County were contributing $400 million a year to the health care system, $400 million. In the last budget, 2017, it was $111 million, roughly. So that's a $300 million difference. And some of that was efficiencies, but most of it was the substitution of federal dollars for local dollars. So the cost to us of the repeal of the Affordable Care Act was at least $300 million. And we estimated that it might be up to $800 million because people would lose coverage not just in our managed care program, but in all the other managed care programs. And the pattern in the past was uninsured people did not go to Northwestern or the University of Chicago hospitals or Rush. They came to Cook County, and that's where they would come back again. So we estimated that the loss of the Affordable Care Act, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, would cost the county anywhere from $300 to $800 million.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, is back to the old days when, you know, county was where everybody went and they didn't have insurance, and that's where, you know, the expenses just piled up.
Well, you know, before the Affordable Care Act, two-thirds of our patients were what we called self-pay. Now, that's a euphemism. It means they couldn't pay. It means we provided the care for them. It was charity care. So the reverse is now the case. Almost two-thirds of our patients have insurance, and that's the result of the Affordable Care Act. Medicaid expansion, the marketplace plans, people now have coverage, and only one-third are self-pay. So, this has been a dramatic shift for us in terms of our insured patient population.
Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
Well, thanks, Rick. I appreciate the invitation. I'll be happy to come back.
Appreciate it. We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be talking to my good friend Tony Arnold from WBEZ-FM in Chicago. We'll be talking about the school impasse and the governor's race and all kinds of things going on in the world of politics.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. Just want to make a personal note here. Mark Silva, who was the longtime Tallahassee bureau chief for the Miami Herald, who went on to cover the White House for your Chicago Tribune, died last week, early Tuesday, at his home in Alexandria, Virginia. He was 63, and in May he had been diagnosed with a brain tumor. Mark was just one of the best guys in the world. Mark was a consummate storyteller. Mark was just a fantastic colleague. He was kind of my counterpart in Tallahassee, Florida, when I was in Springfield, Illinois, covering state government. Knew all the right people. They all knew him, and it's what help make good journalists is it we both had that drive that, you know, we're not going to get beat, and if we get beat we're going to be pretty angry. But Mark, just a consummate gentleman, he covered for the Miami Herald. Part of the reason we hired him for the Miami Herald, he covered the 2000 recount of the presidential race. I mean, he literally knew what those chads were and where they were coming from. And I learned a lot from him. He, at the Tribune, he started one of our early political blogs called The Swamp, and that was, he kind of just shepherded that and just did a fantastic thing. And true to form, on 9/11, with the terrible attacks on the United States, Mark Silva was on pool duty with the President of the United States, George W. Bush, as he was reading to students in a Florida school. And that was a whirlwind trip on a horrible, horrible day. And I can't think of anybody that I would rather have in pool duty representing the press corps than Mark Silva. So my sympathies to Mark and his wife and his family, and he will be very, very much missed. And rest in peace, Mark. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is my good friend Tony Arnold from WBEZ-FM. And as I always joke, we try to bring public radio here to WGN through my show, and we'll do it literally now. But yeah. Tony's been watching all of this school stuff, and one aspect that we've talked about in this whole issue of school funding, and it's all about, frankly, all the attention here is about CPS. And in speaking to Senate Republican Leader Brady, I was trying to broaden that conversation because downstate schools, suburban schools, you know, various tweaks that the governor made in rewriting the bill, they have consequences throughout the state. It's not just Chicago Public Schools. And when the governor says, well, we're going to shift this money so that other schools throughout the state benefit, not just Chicago, well, that might work for the first year or so. It's the out years that are the real question in this.
Right. And I mean, look, we're talking about a formula, right? It's a math formula that it's a very complex way of, this is not seventh grade, you know, art algebra here that we're talking about. There's a lot of factors that go into a formula that decides.
There's political calculus.
There's also that, which is maybe a little bit harder to define than just the hard numbers. But when you're talking about the governor's amendatory veto and how he changed this bill that changes how the state money is dispersed to schools and what poor areas get versus the wealthier areas. We're kind of in this limbo right now where we're waiting to see the hard numbers, right, from the governor's changes, his veto.
Right. The scoring by the State Board of Education to take a look. And the governor, you know, last week said, well, you know, these are going to be the best numbers you ever saw.
He said, you want to see the numbers, go to our website.
Well, that was first.
And then the website got put behind a password protection screen, and you couldn't check it for a while. Now it sounds like this week, to look into the future a little bit here about where this whole thing's going and if schools are going to open or not, it sounds like some numbers are going to be coming out. Like the scoring's been done or is being done, I should say, and maybe we'll get some harder numbers from the Board of Education about what exactly this is going to do.
But one of the things the governor said was, well, part of the reason Democrats held the bill, now, of course, we've heard, because to foment crisis. Mm-hmm. And frankly, there is a effort to create pressure on Republican lawmakers to support an override of the governor's changes. There's no doubt about that. But the governor went on to allude that part of the reason Democrats held the bill was because they didn't want to have the State Board of Education score his changes. And they couldn't do it until he had done his mandatory veto.
Right.
Which a number of people have said, if he wanted to find out what it would do, he could have gotten it scored.
He could have released his own plan.
And oh, yeah. By the way, the State Board of Education is appointed by the governor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and they could have put it in a new bill.
Right.
That kind of thing.
And as we're going through it, and particularly as Democrats who actually get a vote over the future of this mandatory veto go through it, we're starting to see the reaction here. Senator Andy Menar, who's the Senate Democrat's key point person on this whole bill and has been for years, said that he had a map that showed all these districts around the state are going to be losing money, not just Chicago and other parts of the state too. The Civic Federation, which is just this kind of the financial watchdog group in Chicago, it's nonpartisan. They had a report out on Friday going through this saying, well, if the governor's changes go into effect, he factors in how many students are enrolled in a school into the formula, and there's more than 500 schools around the state that have been losing population in terms of students and attendance. So that means less money for those schools down the road. It's not an immediate thing, but it is in a few years. And if that trend continues, then what the governor does would mean less money for those schools.
Well, and that's one thing when we talk about the Board of Education to give these district-by-district scorecard that mm-hmm. it's supposed to come out with later this week. They're not going to factor in out years. So,
right.
You know,
they'll be looking at the immediate, yeah, what's year one kind of, and what the Democrats and Civic Federation, too, are warning is like, well, this is supposed to be for the future, right? It took more than 20 years to get us to ramp up to talk about this right now. And everyone says, well, that was a terrible formula, and the state lived with that for, yeah, as you said, 30 years. So if this is the one shot that there is to do it, that's why you're seeing, I think, so much politics being driven into this as well, because it's not often that you come back to revisit some of these major issues. Think about the pension bill that was passed a few years ago and was found unconstitutional. It's been several years now, and that hasn't been readdressed, but that was a crisis back when that was being talked about. Not that the situation's gotten any better, but you can see
it's
the politics.
It's not the crisis du jour.
It moves from one section to another, right? So if this is the ramp up to this whole changing the school funding formula before school starts, this is, you know, I don't know that next year this is the same conversation could happen. This is kind of the big shot here.
Yes, and even still, it's still steeped in election year politics.
Absolutely, and that's why you're seeing the candidates for governor on the Democratic side are talking about this. You're seeing the governor as he tours the state talking about big bad Chicago to other communities. It's all part of the calculation, right, for how the next year is going to be playing out up until next November.
We're speaking with Tony Arnold, my good friend, politics reporter for WBEZ FM in Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. You're listening to WGN Radio. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. And joining me here in the studio is Tony Arnold, political reporter for WBEZ-FM. We're talking about the issue of the school funding snafu, the fact that we have an amendatory veto from the governor of a Democratic-passed bill, and that amendatory veto doesn't look like it's going anywhere. The question is whether Democrats in both chambers can override the governor's changes, much like they did with Republican assistance in enacting a state budget after 2 years. Now, schools are going to be opening in a matter of days, basically. I haven't heard of any school district that says that schools won't open.
Not for day one.
Right. But that even creates even more uncertainty, because you're talking about the fact if there is no state money flowing through the state aid formula for schools, at what point do some of these schools have to close?
Right.
And that's in the school year. And, you know, it, through all through the two-year-plus impasse over the budget, you know, one of the trigger points everybody thought would be, well, what if the schools can't open? And, of course, the legislature and the governor navigated around that by, for example, vetoing an entire state budget except for the funding for schools.
Isn't that something, right?
Right.
There was an impasse that affected the universities, social services, but the schools...
Schools must open.
They did a budget for the schools, yeah. And now it's the school's turn. There's a state budget, and now it's time for the schools to be at the center of this impasse.
One of the things I told Senate Republican Leader Brady was, you know, in reporting this, and frankly, you and I probably have learned more about the state school aid formula than we ever cared to know, but that in reporting this and also with social media and all that kind of stuff, that I think I've attracted, you know, 100 new followers on my Twitter account who are superintendents, principals, or teachers in downstate Illinois. And you think politically, here you have this Republican version, as you said, we would move to from a district hold harmless that would be a guarantee forever to a floating three-year average of student attendance as the basis for state aid, one of the basis for state aid. And you have these districts that are largely in Republican areas that are affected by the changes in this bill, not only the per pupil issue and number of downstate schools that have been seeing declining enrollment. You also have the issue of the property tax caps that are in the suburbs, and schools can't tap those higher property values because they're capped on what they can levy. Yep. And so, but that would still count against them in how much state aid you get. And everybody knows in the suburbs, they hardly get anything for state aid. That's been why their property taxes are so high.
Yeah. And it's interesting to hear, have this in context of the last 2 years, right? When all this talk's been going on about a freeze of property taxes.
Right.
So not only then are they capped, but then to freeze them for an extended period of time, whether it's 2 years or 4 years. Now, that never got passed, obviously, but it was at one of the key sticking points that...
And it's still one of the key talking points for Governor Rauner.
So, yeah, and there are negotiations, for lack of a better word, that are happening related to this school funding formula impasse between the Republicans and Democrats. It's not between Governor Rauner and Speaker Madigan. They aren't in the room, but they're... allies are, right? Democrats, House Democrats, Senate Democrats, House Republicans, Senate Democrats, Senate Republicans are meeting. And the Republicans have said, we are talking about still some of the same issues, like freezing property taxes, like school mandate reform, and this other idea of they're calling it a tax scholarship fund.
And I want to ask you about
another
that.
Another name is vouchers, but yeah, it's a different form of that.
So what are they talking about? It would be $100 million is the rough number that's being tossed around.
For now, yeah. It's finally we got some more details, I guess, than have been released on late Friday about what this program is, at least what the advocates are calling for who push for this. And this was given to me by a principal on the south side of Chicago who's in favor of it's a private Catholic school that's struggling.
You want to explain how this would...
This draft proposal calls for it's $100 million of a scholarship program. And this would basically allow for people who to be eligible to qualify for a scholarship to go to a private school, a parochial school, even a public school in a different town. And one of the things that jumped out to me about this proposal, and again, it's just a proposal, it's not even in a bill form yet, but to even be discussed publicly. But one of the things that's jumped out to me was who would be eligible for this. It's not just low-income people. It's 2.5 times the people who are eligible for free or reduced lunches. When you do that math, it's about 100. If a family of four makes $114,000 a year, you would qualify for one of these scholarships to send your kid to another school. That is going to drastically change enrollment at public schools around the state. This is a, if this were enacted, I mean, this is a giant change.
And where does the money come from?
Well, the money comes from people who donate to this $100 million fund. It would be basically replacing their tax money is what it would be doing.
Well, you
give your money, your tax money to this scholarship fund, and that's diverting your tax money from the state government to this school pot of money.
Because it would be an income tax deduction.
That's right. And so, and one other part of this draft proposal is, yeah, it's a $100 million program in year one. If they raise 90% of their funding, basically $90 million in year one, then it can, this calls for letting it grow 25% every year after that. So in year two, it'd be $125 million. In year three, keep doing that math. Too much for me. I can't do it.
It's too early
but
on a Sunday.
The point is that it keeps it can keep growing, and more people can keep contributing even more money to this program. And so it's it would just be a complete change to so much about how students think about, how parents think about school for their students in Illinois. This would be a drastic change. It's something that other states have enacted similar programs to this, and in here around Illinois, the Catholic Church has been supportive of this because they have Catholic schools, right? And so this is something that it's something that hasn't really been talked about that much, but we did some reporting on it when Governor Rauner first came on board because he was talking about this very plan.
So, but when you throw that into the mix, and what we were just talking about, this issue of shifting the funding kind of base to a per pupil for mm-hmm. public schools, mm-hmm. you throw this kind of into the mix and the effects that that could have on that per pupil funding issue.
Right. That in theory, then you're going to have fewer, even fewer kids in public school. And then if this formula, you know, were passed, then that's that in this as it is, which it doesn't sound like it will, but we'll see. Then that would be even less money for public
schools. And even though these scholarships would be funded, vouchers be funded by donations to this, it would still result in a $100 million loss to the state treasury.
Yeah, I mean that's money that's not going
because
to the state
tax
government. It's
deduction.
going to attack this scholarship program exactly. Yeah.
So at a time when the state is still having trouble paying its bills, bills that would include paying for public school education, it, there's the potential that there could be this $100 million loss.
If this all
or,
goes
or,
into
or
effect,
diversion,
right?
As it were.
Yeah.
So
now I think there's been some questions. Again, this is a draft of a proposal, and these negotiations, these are sidebars to the overall right. mandatory veto.
And truly, we have not we sought to elicit a response from the governor on this as whether mm-hmm. this is a must-have component for any final deal.
It sounds like he wants it. We also got a statement from the House Republican leader, Jim Durkin, who said that he would like to see it as a part of negotiations or a part of a final deal. But he also said, you know, things are very fluid right now. As far as how much of a political reality this is, I think that there could be some bipartisan support. But the thing to remember here is that the unions, the teachers unions, really do not like this program for some kind of obvious reasons, because it's going to take public school students away. And so then at a time when there's been this whole union fight, right, going on in Springfield between the Republicans and Democrats, are the Democrats really going to upset some of the base, some of their base here as a result of this program?
Particularly as we get ever closer to the 2018 elections.
There you go.
Tony Arnold from WBEZ-FM, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks
I
for
appreciate
having
it very much. We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Illinois Senate Republican Leader Bill Brady from Bloomington, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, my good buddy Tony Arnold from WBEZ-FM. I also want to thank all of you, and I also want to give a special shout-out to some of my great buds from the days of Willowbrook High School. We used to sneak out of school one day in the summer. Well, before school let out, we'd sneak out and play at this little 9-hole golf course in Lombard called Kenlock. And my buds have to this day continued the annual tradition of the Kenlock Open, although it's moved. They hold it, they go everywhere across the country. And of course, they picked this weekend to play in Springfield, Illinois, where I know all the courses, except I'm going to be down there next week when it's state fair time. So I didn't get a chance to go down there and play. But I want to wish all my Willowbrook buds a great time down at the Kenlock Open.
How old were you when you first met these guys?
Oh, how old was I? Well, some of them, I was 10 years old.
That's cool.
Yeah. But it's kind of our own little reunion.
Very nice.
Except I've never done the reunion. But,
very nice.
But they played in like Atlanta and northern Wisconsin and California. I mean,
that's fun.
Yeah. I wish I could be there.
It's fun. It's fun hanging out with old buds, from back in the day.
Well, and they even hooked up with one of our old coaches and gym teachers who lives down in Taylorville, right by Springfield. And they got together with him for breakfast. And
nice.
I hope they bought. Right. Exactly. I do know these guys.
I get together with some of my old friends that I grew up with. I'm still friends with a lot of people that I went to grade school with.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the nice things about living and working in your hometown is you're literally your lifelong friends. But we don't have any traditions like that. If we did, it would be like going on the schoolyard and smoking cigarettes. Let's go smoke some cigarettes.
Acting like derelicts.
I stole one of my dad's.
I'll run out and get you some Lucky Strikes.
Yeah, Marlboros, please.